On March 3rd, 1974, Mr. Theodore Donovan, age 50, made a note on the kitchen calendar. His daughter Patty's car had just gotten a flat tire on a trip to the drugstore. This is about the only time since I started coming to the festival comfortable. Am I moving too fast? About the first time since I started coming to the festival comfortable that I wish I was here with a clerical collar on and a suit and had my hair properly coiffured. Because when people turn by tonight, and then I wish I had my PhD from Stanford in a frame and a chain hanging on my chest around my neck. Because when I read this story and the stations come and go tonight, dress my presidential way, people are going to think I'm a nut. I'd sort of enjoyed dressing casual, talking about high theological subjects. But when I talk on this subject, I should wear a clerical collar and look like the Dean of Notre Dame. But such as I am, here I am tonight. On March 3rd, 1974, Mr. Theodore Donovan, age 50, made a note on the kitchen calendar. I said that, didn't I? His daughter Patty's car had just gotten a flat tire on a trip to the drugstore. Pouring himself another Sunday morning cup of coffee, Ted Donovan could hardly have imagined that this seemingly ordinary event was the beginning of an all-out siege by violent, inhuman spirits that would begin with acts of vandalism and end in the near total destruction of his small ranch house. Now, I'm not going to read through the Ouija board incident. His 19-year-old daughter, Patty, had started messing around with a Ouija board. I'm just going to read this. This is a Catholic presentation. I'm beginning to teach on demonology. I'll teach it from the New Testament and Old Testament frame. I could have started by reading the book by Lester Summerall about the girl in the prison in Manila that was bitten by demons and had bite marks on her body in places that she could not reach, had been put in isolation, and Lester Summerall had come to town, and he requested permission to go exorcise the demon out of the girl. You can check the newspapers in Manila, go to the archives. All I know is that when I used to preach at Bethel Temple, Christ is the Answer Church in Manila, I could get in any taxi and say, take me to the Christ is the Answer Church. They'd take me there. They knew where it was. I get started with that. But everybody would have said, just another Pentecostal story. And there's so much going on in overkill on some of the networks that seek to be so super spiritual. I sought an introduction to this subject four removed from that frame. Catholic. This 19-year-old daughter began working with a Ouija board. It talked back to her. Is there anybody there? It said yes. And she developed an intimate relationship with some unseen presence that identified himself with some young man that had died quite some time earlier. She asked him his name, and he said he wasn't allowed to do it, to tell her his name. Patty's overwhelming involvement with an unknown spirit soon made her even more curious and impatient. She craved to see him. Write some dates down. Late Saturday night, March 2nd. It's March 3rd, 1974. That Her father notes she has a flat tire. Late Saturday night, March 2nd, Patty, using the Ouija board, pleaded with her, quote, invisible boyfriend to manifest. Just once, she told the spirit. She wanted to see what he looked like. Now, I have only one goal in reading this story and others, whether you believe this one or not, and I find it hard. This is my sixth reading now. But I am telling you, these are not nuts. These are reputable people. And I don't know how it could be timed accidentally that after I started on this, the networks are showing Amityville Horror on the TV. It was a lousy movie, but a terrifying incident. And these people, Ed and Lorraine Warren, were in the middle of it, called in as the experts. One of maybe a dozen people in America renowned for dealing the way they do with demonic forces. Now, my purpose, once again, is to prove up God's Word. The Bible suggests that man used to be very smart and got dumb. Science suggests man used to be a caveman, very stupid, and got smart. The pyramid and Atlantis prove up the Bible. Archaeology proves up the Bible. Man was once very, very... The Dogon people prove up the Bible. Man was once very, very smart and somewhere lost it. And is now struggling back. The Bible makes it very clear that there is a dimension of invisible and unseen spirits more powerful than we can ever be. And that we are sort of caught between in a conflict that is warfare between forces of evil personified and the ultimate forces of good personified. Philosophy gives you many choices of what God is like. The Bible lays on personalism, that ultimate reality is personal, personality. And that there is a war between personalities that are evil and personalities that are good who will ultimately triumph. And they were once all in the good camp, if the Bible's true, but Jesus beheld Satan cast out, and the Old Testament tells us the basis for him being cast out. There are scenes such as the prophet who is going to an engagement with the enemy, and his servant is scared spitless, and the prophet says, God opened his eyes, and suddenly scales drop from his eyes, is the biblical phrase, and he sees the hills covered with what previously had been invisible forces. We read the Bible through in 72 and 82. An angel kills 180,000 heavily armed soldiers in one night. Law. That's just Bible, you know. Things in the Bible don't really happen, you know. The angel hears the prayer of Daniel, but is resisted 3 weeks getting there. Moses dies, and the New Testament says Michael and Satan wrestled over the body, fought over it. Myth. I'm in the business of proving up the Bible. I have only one goal, whether you believe this story or not, before I'm done with all the stories that are available. It's like Do you believe all things are told by the Bermuda Triangle? Well, I'm not really sure. We got a few of them that are unfinished. But there's too much there to ignore, and why did I read about it? Because I wanted to impress upon you there are some strange things that happen in and around the Bermuda Triangle. You got it. Yeah. Well, there are just too many occurrences to be classified as encounters with unseen, invisible, powerful forces that the scripture called demonic to ignore. You won't find much of this in scientific textbooks because they start out with an assumption that doesn't allow them to include some unexplainable things. Now, I don't know if this happened just the way it's described, but the rest of the book is very credible. There are locations and names. I'm going to check this out. I mean, I'll take resumes from people who want to go check it out. Why are you taking so long to get into this? Because it's so unbelievable. Late Saturday night, March 2nd, she pleaded for him to manifest. Just once, she told the Spirit, she wanted to see what he looked like. The next day, Sunday morning, Ted Donovan went out and tried to start his car. It wouldn't start. Lifting up the hood, he found the spark plug wires pulled out. The rubber hose is unfastened. The fan belt cut. Not much later, Patty tried to start her car, too. It wouldn't start either. Finally had to be towed away to a local garage. The next day, mechanics surmised an internal engine parts had been disassembled. That week, other incidents of apparent vandalism occurred around the Donovan house. The back doorbell was torn out of its housing. Foundation shrubs were yanked out of the ground, roots and all. On the roof, a 6-foot cast iron pipe housing electrical wires was unaccountably bent at a 90-degree angle. On Friday, March 8th, Ted Donovan marked one flat on the kitchen calendar. No sooner did Patty get her car back from the shop than one of her other tires lost air. The next day, Saturday, her father made the same entry on the calendar, although this time it seemed the tire had been cut with a knife. In the meantime, inexplicably, by the way, nobody has ever explained those crypts that moved, those caskets that moved around inside that crypt. The government just buried them elsewhere and left the crypt to whomever was in there that didn't like to be crowded. Eight men had to move that one casket. Yet it's... Just remember, I told that story in conjunction with the Bermuda Triangle. Pull it out and give it double billing. I want it in conjunction with demonic activity now. Okay? And that crypt was about like this house is going to become. Only difference, in fact, probably some of these people in this house should have been told about that crypt there in the Bermuda Triangle area so they could have stood themselves up in the wooden casket. They might have been left alone. Remember, one old lady got spared in that crypt. Let's continue. In the meantime, inexplicably, Patty could no longer raise her invisible boyfriend on the Ouija board. Night after night, she tried to communicate, but the planchette would simply move or slide over to goodbye. She had no idea that her ethereal bow had actually manifested in the form of a supernatural vandal. By the second week of March, material damage to the house and cars had become so troublesome that Ted Donovan complained to the police. just dawns on me. They haven't told me which town this is in yet, have they? Just keep watching till we find what town. That bothers me. Where do these Donovan people live? I'm going to get mad if they haven't told me and start disbelieving it even more. Let's just watch, see if the town ever comes up. I don't see it anywhere. Okay, let's go on. But I'm going to check with the police. Ted Donovan complained to the police. I mean, if this is not true, I think we ought to do a sit-in on Prentice Hall. The all-out siege experienced by a Connecticut family of four. Okay, we got it in Connecticut now. I got a lot of people in Connecticut can check this out. By the second week of March, material damage to the house and cars had become so troublesome that Ted Donovan complained to the police. Now, I'm going to tell you, I've been telling people this for 9 years, listen to me. There are a lot of demons loose in New England. I'll fit them. I mean, I've been there and fought them. I've told you that every city in the hierarchy of Satan's rule as the prince of the power of the air, every city, demons and understudies of Satan have their territory assigned. The prince of the power of the air has dispersed and assigned territories to all of them. As the prince of Persia ruled there, and those earthly kings thought they were in charge, there is a evil prince for every city, from Chico, California, to Memphis, to Springfield, Massachusetts. Any person that studied the history of revivals throughout church history will tell you that no great revival has ever come to any city without a body of people exercising the laws of the Spirit in such a way that they finally break Satan's hold on that territory. And I have said over and over again that one of the reasons why every preacher wants to gain access to Los Angeles, and one of the reasons why the Los Angeles supports just about every ministry that gets into Los Angeles, is that way back there somebody broke Satan's hold on this city. That's why I want, probably won't be successful, but that's why I want more than anything that I've ever wanted since I've been in Los Angeles. I want the opportunity to buy the church at the Open Door, but I'm sure I won't be able to. I'm sure they'll sell it for the air rights, for millions, move the church to the suburbs. But I'm going to tell Los Angeles, when that stone front on that church, Ironside and Gee's pulpit, when that stone front on that church down there on Hope Street that reads in the stone across the entrance to the church, "Forever, O Lord, thy word is settled in heaven." When a wrecking bar mashes that, the demons that want to control Los Angeles will rejoice. There'll be thousands, just like people in Jerusalem were unaware of what happened the night Jesus was crucified. When that wrecking ball hits the front of that church, find J. Vernon McGee, I bet you he'll tell you that's the way he feels. When the wrecking ball hits the front of that church, do you have any idea what a party Satan's going to have to see the words crumble in order that the great God Mammon, the almighty dollar in King Dollar's court, might be served. "Forever, O Lord, thy word settled in heaven," crush. And when those two giant signs, red neon signs, that proclaimed down through the decades, Jesus saves. From those twin towers on each side of the church that used to house Biola, go down with that stone front on the church and that vast auditorium of more than 4,000 seats that has had some of the greatest preaching of the word ever to be heralded forth from the Church of the Open Door. When that crashes, oh, I'm sure the church will be a strong suburban church. But a thorn in the eye of Satan will finally be plucked out. I laugh every time I drive through Los Angeles, because it's one of the last airspaces around over that church. And the glass towers have gone up on all sides that just reflect the sign. Just reflects the sign. No, it's none of my business what the church does. They have a right to do what they want. I just would like to buy it. I bet you I could bring my King's Houses there. That's why I'm wanting you to pack out King's House 1 now. But my real concern, whether I ever went to preach in the church or not, my real concern is what I know about demon forces. That Los Angeles has had an openness to the gospel because somebody broke Satan's hold. The Azusa Street revival was not an accident. With all the flim-flam of the media, nobody can take away from Amy Semple McPherson what she did. And it's only a carnal media that projects a perfectionism that is anti-scriptural onto its own view of what ministers ought to be. That gives them a basis for criticizing. Her work and the fruit of her work remains. There's a reason why Catherine Kuhlman used to come out here. And I know enough of the history of her work to know the support that came out of Los Angeles. There are other cities, the same amount of effort. It's like beating your head against a wall. San Francisco is a city where no one has ever broken Satan's hold. Whatever prince rules over that area, it's never been broken. And that springboard of revival in America, New England, once the vitality ebbed, and I'm going to tell you how it ebbed. It ebbed when perfectionist works of those blessed Puritans were substituted for the life of the Spirit. And Satan will come in, always. He comes in under the guise of an angel of light. And I have noticed that the cities that are the hardest to break Satan's power are the churchiest cities. I went to school in Oroville, California, both literally and spiritually. That's the churchiest town I've ever been in. The only close approximate is Glendale. But I'm telling you, Satan rules that self-righteous, hypocritical little town. Revival's well nigh impossible. Satan's moved into the synagogue. And I've noticed that churchy towns get that way, particularly churchy towns that are proud of their religion. Because spiritual pride is the one sin God can't deal with without totally breaking you. Now, I love New England. I've proven in the 9 years that I would stay in New England. But I have contended with the demon forces in New England. And the power that New England had for revival Satan took his lumps once. When a preacher like Jonathan Edwards would preach and people literally hung onto the pews for fear they'd slide into hell, the reality of his preaching and their emotional reactions were so strong. But once that fire was cooled, Satan moved extra troops into that territory. It was the establishment fountainhead of revival for America. And he wanted to cap that fountain over. And he did. So I'm not surprised that this is New England. Just thought I'd say that. When the law arrived, Ted Donovan pointed out the destruction done to the garden plants and shrubs, the exterior of the house, and the apparent intrusion into a locked garage to puncture tires and tear engines apart. Once he had even heard someone pound on the house from outside. Before leaving, the policeman assured Ted, a respectable member of the community, that they'd keep an eye on the property during night patrols. Oh, my Lord, I'm leaving some people. You want me to continue? Does this subject interest you? I'm reading from The Demonologist, The Extraordinary Career of Ed and Lorraine Warren. Now, you remember where I started with this, don't you? The Warrens were called in for the Amityville Horror incident. To those that are involved in dealing with exorcism and demonology, they're one of about a dozen people that have spent their life with this problem. Remember, we read the story of as Ed was preparing for his report on the Amityville Horror. He was in his office at his own home. Ed Warren's office is located in a small cottage-sized building attached to the main house by a long enclosed passageway. As Ed sat working on preliminary details of the Amityville case, that fateful February morning, the latch at the end of the passageway snapped open, followed by the percussive boom of the heavy wooden door. Footsteps then started toward the office. Ed leaned back in his chair, waiting for Lorraine to enter with a much-needed cup of coffee. But it wasn't Lorraine. An ominous, swirling sound built in power and intensity. Suddenly, the desk lamp dimmed to the strength of a candle flame. Then, abruptly, the temperature in the office plunged to that of a walk-in freezer. And then you know the thing that entered his office. Now, if you weren't here the night I read that, well, too bad. I'm going on tonight. Now, you remember when I read none other than the general who was the superintendent of West Point called these people in because there was a ghost stealing people's billfolds at West Point? Now, neither one of those sound very believable. Did you remember somebody called in the night that was in the class that heard their lecture that year at West Point? Now, I said, I've read the story I'm going to read to you tonight 5 times. Found it equally unbelievable each of the 5 times. This is number 6. Every bone in my body says this couldn't happen. All of my discipline, scientific and academic training says, wait a minute. Somebody real smart was playing tricks on these people. And I said to an earlier audience, this is one of the times I wish that I had worn my clerical collar, dark suit, and put my PhD degree from Stanford University in a frame with a chain connected to it and wore it around my neck like the breastplate of the high priest. Because what I'm going to read is going to have people think that he's nuts. These are good Catholic people. These are famous people. We get on the subject and the TV follows. I'm really delighted that we have convinced TV at large that there are some brains out there that ought to be appealed to. Tonight, George C. Scott's talking on mysteries like the crystal skull, out-of-the-body experiences, and writings on the plateau of Peru. And last week they showed the Amityville Horror Story, a lousy movie, but a subject that should have been treated right. Any of you see The Exorcist? Now, the reason that I teach is to prove up the Bible. I'm tired of people thinking you can't keep your head on your shoulders and be a Christian. I contend that all truth, an open mind, honestly searching, will bring them to questions that only God can answer or answers God's already given. Now, the Bible has said for centuries a man was very smart, degenerated, and with God's help has improved, but can never solve his problems without an entry into history from the one beyond history who will set things right. People scared of a Holocaust where man will destroy himself. The Bible says that won't happen. God will stop it before it does. Now, you study the Dogon people. You study the pyramid. You study Atlantis and the evidence for it. You're going to conclude that the Bible has got more support than the theory that man came out of the cave, struck a spark and got some fire and has been progressively getting better. It's the other way around. Man was Superman by comparison to what he now is at some time in the distant past. Science builds on the faith that things have always been as they are and will always be as they are. The Bible teaches great cataclysms that will shake and reshape the world. You can't read the Bible and believe that the sun stood still. Now, the Bible's not describing a scientific event in scientific terms. It's describing a scientific happening in apprehension terms by the one who saw it. To him, it looked as though the sun stood still. We know the earth stopped turning. That long day of Joshua could not occur without a cataclysm affecting the world worldwide. There's got to be evidence somewhere around the world that such a happening described in the Bible as the long day of Joshua. If he had a long day, somebody on the other side of the world had a long night. And Velikovsky has put to rest the arguments as to whether or not such evidence can be found. He found it. Cataclysms, as described in the Bible, previous ages, the world that then was, by contrast with the one that's recreated from Genesis 1, 2 on. Likewise, the Bible suggests the presence of unseen, powerful, supernatural forces contesting with God, and we're sort of the innocent ones caught in between. Not always the innocent, but innocent in many cases of the power of these forces that are at work. The Bible describes a scene, as I said earlier, of a servant of a prophet complaining in his fear, and the prophet says to God, open his eyes, and suddenly, as the scripture says, the scales dropped, and he saw hillsides covered with the army of the Lord. One angel killed 180,000 Sennacherib's troops in one night. Tyre was ruled by Satan. The prophet begins to talk about the prince of Tyre, and suddenly he's talking about Lucifer himself. Persia was ruled by a prince of Persia, an evil demon force. The book of Revelation says, in time of tribulation, 200 million demons have been chained in the area of the Euphrates River. Now, if there's a place in the world that has doves on cruelty, it's that area. We just don't know how to adjust to a mullah that gloats over the dead bodies of American servicemen that were trying to rescue our hostages in Tehran. We have no way to comprehend the cruelty of a Khomeini. It was that area that broke Lawrence of Arabia. The movie's very accurate. He was never the same after the torture he suffered. There's a pervasive, evil, resonant force chained in that area to be released to the world. And there's a bottomless pit somewhere where Abaddon and his hordes of locust demons will come out. Now, where's that? Where are these demons going to come from? One of these stars out here? Is it? Now, there's no such thing as a bottomless pit in the Scripture. The word's abyss. Alternately translated, the deep. Could the deep be somewhere around the Bermuda Triangle? Or that place in the off Japan, its counterpart? There are 12 such places on the earth, by the way, but Bermuda Triangle's got the most going for it. Is it possible that those demons in the bottomless pit, as the book of Revelation talks about, the abyss, is actually somewhere on this earth? Now, the Old Testament suggests that the demons were consigned to the deep, and it is a suggestion of a watery deep. Now, I'll tell you this, you ever run into a great white shark, you're very sure that you found one of their relatives. Now, I don't want to be considered a nut, but I'm in the business of demonstrating that the Bible is sound. You never stop thinking when you read it. In fact, if you think, some questions are going to come out the church better deal with. Now, you read the little Gospel of Mark. Everywhere Jesus goes, he finds demons. Mark. Cast out devils, unclean spirits. Every chapter he's run into them, even in the synagogue. Everywhere he goes, unclean spirits, devils and demons. Then the fifth chapter, he comes to this country of the Gadarenes. When he was come out of the ship, immediately they met him out of the tombs, a man with an unclean spirit. He broke chains, broke fetters, no man could tame him. Always night and day he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. But when he saw Jesus afar off, ran worshiping and cried with a loud voice, "What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee, God, by God, that thou torment me not." For he said unto him, "Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit." He asked him, "What's your name?" He answered, saying, "My name is Legion, for we are many." And he besought him much that he would not send them away out of the country. They wouldn't stay there. So they asked they'd go in the pigs. And you can read the Bible through in 72 and say, "Oh, that's just not." I'm in the business of looking for evidence that these unseen, powerful forces exist. Now, I could deal with West Point. A lot of credible people there to talk about that ghost. We finished that story, didn't we? And those black mass swirling things that came into Ed and Lorraine's place. And the Amityville horror. I'm telling you, going out the gate, this one, I've read it five times, and all my academic natural instinct says, this can't happen. But I can tell you it could happen. And there's a biblical basis for such forces working. Now, I'm taking applications for people who go do the research for me. Check this out. They can do a dissertation on it. Well, somebody gave me a name for it. We'll call it ghost-busting applications. I mean, if I don't have people living in the area that can check this out for me, I'm going to hire somebody to go do it. Scary story. You ready? You've been ready, haven't you?
Yes, sir.
March 3rd, 1974. Mr. Theodore Donovan, age 50, made a note on the kitchen calendar. He didn't know what he was getting in for. His daughter Patty's car had gotten a flat tire on a trip to the drugstore. What he didn't know is his 19-year-old daughter had been working with a Ouija board for quite some time, beginning by asking the Ouija board one night, is there anybody there? The flashette moved to yes. And it began to commune with her, claiming to be a kind of teenage angel, the spirit of a young lad that allegedly had died sometime earlier. Every night she talked to him on the Ouija board, began to fantasize. This was her unseen boyfriend. Her curiosity got the better of her, and late Saturday night, March 2nd, write it down, she pleaded for this unseen force communicating with her on the Ouija board to manifest. I already told you, I find this hard to believe. That's why nobody's talking about these things. It upsets our neat little lifestyle. Late Saturday night, she pleaded for him to manifest. Just once, she told the spirit, she wanted to see what he looked like. The next day, Sunday morning, Ted Donovan went out and tried to start his car. It wouldn't start. Patty's wouldn't start. Hers had to be towed. The mechanic said it looked like, and they surmised the internal parts of the engine had been disassembled. Other vandalism began to follow around the house. Back doorbell torn out of its roots, or torn out of its housing. Foundation shrubs yanked out of the ground, roots and all. On the roof, a 6-foot cast iron pipe. Housing electrical wires unaccountably bent at a 90-degree angle. Now, a cast iron pipe will normally break. That's what makes that all the more significant. In the meantime, Patty could no longer raise her invisible boyfriend. Every time she tried to talk to him, the planchette would move to goodbye. By the second week of March, material damage to the house and cars had become so troublesome, Ted complained to the police. I'm reading The Demonologist by Gerald Brittle, Prentice Halls, the publisher. He called the cops. He couldn't understand what was going on. He explained it to them. The intrusion and the damage to their cars was into a locked car. Once he'd even heard someone pound on the house from the outside, and the cops came. Before leaving, the policeman assured Ted, a respectable member of the community, they'd keep an eye on the property during night patrols. Later, that second week, however, came the first indication that the damage had nothing to do with prankish neighborhood kids. After work, Ted and his wife Ellen were sitting in the kitchen questioning Brian about his friends. He was a teenage boy. Were these incidents of vandalism the outgrowth of some sort of high school feud? Suddenly, all three heard something smash against a wall somewhere inside the house. Cautiously moving to investigate, they found a gaping 18-inch hole in the plasterboard wall in Brian's room. Now, answer the phones over at King's House 1. We're busy here. Just as upsetting was the fact. Don't you start listening to me over at King's House 1. Turn the lights up and answer the phone. Turn the lights down in here. Way down. Just leave me here. Put them in the dark. Cautiously moving to investigate, they found a gaping 18-inch hole in the plasterboard wall in Brian's room. Just as upsetting was the fact that the jagged holes of the plasterboard were pointing inward to the studying, outward from the room. The blow had been delivered from inside the house. For the Donovans, the strange vandalism took on a sobering new dimension. That night, when they went to bed, the Donovans could hear scratchings inside the walls. It sounded like a squirrel had gotten into the house. Listening in the dark, Ted also heard the sound of a board being pried loose. Leaping out of bed, he switched on the lights and spent the next half hour checking the house from cellar to attic. He found no loose boards. In fact, he found nothing out of place. Yet the same weird, troublesome noises continued all week long. In the meantime, Patty's car had already suffered 3 flat tires, so Ted bought her a new set of radios. On Tuesday, March 19th, in the locked garage, one of her new radial tires went flat. It seemed to have been slit with a knife. The garage was locked. That third week of March, the phenomena began to intensify. After nightfall, something again began to pound on the Donovan house from outside. The hard kaboom-type wallops came in series of 3. Hitting with so much force, they shook the house. Naturally, Ted went out to investigate, but there wasn't anything to be seen. At least a dozen times that week, he and Brian went outside with flashlights, vainly trying to find the source of the pounding. I told you, I've read it 5 times, and I'm having difficulty believing it. But I know the reputation of these people. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
As the third week wore on, sharp, jarring raps were heard inside the house as well. This quickly upgraded in power until the sound was like that of a grown person beating on the walls. When the family went to bed, the random poundings and scratchings continued. Around midnight, the sound of boards being torn off the walls could be heard throughout the small ranch house. The weekend of March 20th and 21st, the pressure valves on the steam radiators somehow became unscrewed, spewing hot water all over the walls and carpets. Ted's first inclination was to blame Patty or Brian, but they weren't home when it happened. Puzzled, yet upset, he methodically replaced the radiator cylinders, but every few hours they came loose again, inflicting more water damage. Finally, he turned off the heat in the basement. Meanwhile, the pounding was becoming more frequent and intense. Rather than relax that weekend, Ted Donovan, a man with 23 years' experience in machine design, nearly tore his house apart looking for the source of the noises. After wasting a whole Sunday, he gave up. The next morning, desperate for peace and quiet, Ted capitulated and called both the furnace repairman and the plumber. The furnace repairman arrived early in the morning on Tuesday, the fourth week of March, and declared the furnace to be in perfect working order. But he too heard the pounding noises and ultimately spent some 19 hours in the Donovan house trying to stop the intermittent poundings. In the end, all he could tell Ted and Ellen was that the sounds are not being caused by the furnace. On Wednesday, the plumber came to examine the radiators. Ted was at work at his manufacturing plant, but Ellen explained that every day or two, or rather at every day, 1 or 2 pressure valves would unscrew themselves, spewing out steam and hot water. She also told him about the pounding on the walls and the nocturnal scratchings. The plumber tested for pressure leaks, but the radiators were also in perfect working order. As a precaution, he replaced the old valves with new ones, cinching them down with all his strength. Yet, strangely, no sooner did he move on than the new cylinder would be found lying on the floor beside the radiator. There's got to be a way to find these repair people. I'm going to send somebody to Connecticut to check this out. Now, I don't need this story. It's like the Bermuda Triangle, you know. I read enough that if you don't believe some of them, you are getting convinced that some strange things go on in around the Bermuda Triangle. Now, there are some strange, inexplicable, unseen forces that work, and it's time we look. I want to check this one out. After testing and repairing the radiators two full times, he finally put the old cylinders back on. He then packed up his tools and said to Ellen Donovan, "Lady, you got yourself a problem." You know, I can almost hear a New England radiator man say that. You can almost hear it. That same week, another of Patty's new tires was slashed with a knife, although the car was parked inside the locked garage as usual. However, flat tires have become insignificant compared to the turmoil going on inside the house. Each day, particularly after sunset, oh my Lord, we're leaving some people. The poundings on the house and walls grew louder and louder. The percussive blows often went on for hours on end. Into the night, pictures and decorations fell off the walls from the force of the impact. Valiantly, the Donovans tried to cope with the unreasonable problem by going out to dinner, milling through shopping malls, and frequenting drive-in movies that could keep them away as late as possible. Though the family's early attempts to avoid the ruckus provided some temporary respite, what had happened so far was really only a prelude to the pandemonium that was in store on Sunday, March 31st. Come on over, Ron. Gotta go. I'm so sorry. I gotta leave some places. You that are still with me, like Dallas and Memphis and these other stations, you ought to be glad, Los Angeles and San Francisco, New England. I'm gonna keep going. Right after the station break, I'll be right back. What can we play?